is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and that is music from a ceremony in Washington today honoring the late Congressman John Lewis. D.C. leaders paid tribute to him in the Capitol Rotunda. His casket was driven around Washington, D.C., and then placed at the center of the rotunda. And there, members of Congress listened to a recording of these words from the former congressman himself about his message for young people keeping up the fight for justice and equality in the U.S.
There may be some setbacks, some delays, some disappointment, but you must never, ever give up or give in. You must keep the faith and keep your eyes on the prize. That is your calling. That is your mission. That is your moral obligation. That is your mandate. Get out there and do it. Get in the way.
Yesterday, Lewis's body was marched across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, the very bridge that Lewis walked across with other protesters on what's now known as Bloody Sunday in March 1965. We want to start today by reflecting on the life of John Lewis with two local leaders, and we want you to join us too. Did you watch the ceremony today? How are you remembering the congressman? Did the music spark memories in you? Are you feeling inspired, sad, looking to what's coming next? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With us now is Reverend Mariama White Hammond, pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester. Reverend Mariama, welcome back to Radio Boston.
It's an honor to be here.
Also with us is Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor and now CEO of Verdant Medical, a cannabis company. Tito, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
And Tito, I will start with you. You know, my first thought is that it's a sad day, but sad doesn't seem like the right word. It doesn't seem to run deep enough. What's on your mind today as you reflect?
I just think of the legacy that was lived here, but also the baton that John Lewis worked so hard to pass to the generation that Mariama and I occupy. And just thinking, I'm 45 now, he started his walk when he was 15. And just to think about what that means. And then also, you know, he said every generation leaves behind a legacy. What that legacy will be determined by the people of that generation. What legacy do you want to leave behind? That question should urge all of us to stand up every day, to get up every day, to do things that will create a more just and fair world, society, country, and municipality.
Reverend Mariama, let me just turn to you and invite you to reflect as well to start.
So I had the opportunity to meet Congressman Lewis twice. The first time was when I was 15. There were a group of us as part of a civil rights tour. So for many years, I led a youth organization that took young people on civil rights tours. But this is when I myself was a young person, just the summer before my junior year in high school. And we got to meet him in his office. And his message was exactly what people are hearing today. He was very encouraging of young people. This was only the second year that tour was happening with Project Hip Hop. And he made space in his busy schedule to meet with a group of young people from Boston going south to study and learn about the civil rights movement. His legacy is one that I'm glad we're taking the opportunity to honor. And it is a sad day to an extent, but I think in our faith tradition, we believe that death does not have the final word. So yes, I do believe that it is tough to see him cross over from this side to the ancestors. But we believe that the legacy that one leaves doesn't end with your time on earth. And he has left a powerful legacy. And I am grateful to have met him, grateful to have known a lot of the sort of lesser known people that he organized with in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. But for me, this is a moment of deep reflection. And I hope many young people, even if they are just being introduced to him now, will take this as an opportunity to reflect, because we need folks to rise up in this period. We need folks to really ask what the soul of this country should be, and then to fight for it. And I think he never stopped doing that.
Let me pick up on that specifically, because in listening to you, Reverend Mariam, I also think, Tito, about what you said at the beginning of your comments about the passing of the baton. What is that baton, Tito? How would you characterize, what's the baton that's been passed to your generation and that is now starting to be passed to the next?
As Mariam is kind of interesting, we've actually never had this conversation. I got to meet John Lewis twice also, one in Boston during a march. Before that in 2000 with the Dunphy family. And the baton, though, is the baton that he has always been passing, the one of purpose, one of standing up for righteousness. And it's the baton that we're seeing with the folks who are in the streets on a daily basis, ensuring that there's accountability for Black lives that have been destroyed and that are being harmed. And I think we can't, I know people, there are those who would like to not acknowledge that what's happening today, the young people who are in the streets today, the young people whose voices are out there today, there is an inextricable link to the movement. And this is our civil rights movement. And what are we going to do in our time to ensure equity in education? What are we going to do to close the gap when it comes to, in Massachusetts or in Boston, $247,500, the net worth of white folks, and $8 is the net worth of Black folks? Disparities in death, disparities in health, disparities relative to COVID-19. There are so many things that we have to do. And the question is, what are we as an individual on a day-to-day basis willing to do and give to stand up for righteousness and justice?
Let's go to the phones here. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join and reflect with us today. We have Mary on the line from Lancaster. Mary, go ahead.
Hi, yes. I just want to say that we keep hearing the question, who's next to step up? And we're all next. And also, if they could stop referring to Black American to simply just Black man, Black woman. Just include them in America. Thank you. I'll drop the call now. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. And Reverend Mariam, I want to focus on that first. We're all who's next. I've heard a lot of reflections on whether or not we have the leadership we need in this moment and how local and grassroots is a place of great promise for us right now. What do you think of that?
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting as someone who's, you know, gotten the opportunity to go visit little small towns in Alabama and Mississippi and meet folks who, you know, John Lewis, yes, his legacy is amazing, but he started off as a young person with a dream and a young person who refused to accept the status quo. And I think that's something every single one of us can do. I think it's important to celebrate him and honor him, but sometimes we lionize people in such a way that it makes it feel like the work they've done is inaccessible to the rest of us. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, every single one of us can choose to be discontented with the status quo and stand up. And while we do need leaders, I'm not gonna deny that leadership matters, we also could be a more leaderful society where many of us are stepping up and doing things in our backyard. That's how movements are born. They're not, I think people tend to think some great leader just comes in whole cloth and suddenly there's a movement. The reality is movements take off because lots of people in small communities who at the beginning may not even know each other find courage, and then the courage of each of those folks begins to feed off of each other. So I celebrate his legacy, but I think he would be much more excited to see hundreds and thousands of people stepping up than to see one more great leader emerge.
And we have talked a lot about grassroots in the last several weeks, especially here on Radio Boston. It is notable that today was a day to hear from Washington, from our elected leaders in Washington. And I do want to note we'll also have Representative Ayanna Pressley on the show tomorrow to talk about how she's thinking about John Lewis's legacy. I want to hear a little more from the ceremony, from some of those voices. And I'm going to start here with Republican Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who spoke about what he admired about Congressman Lewis.
John Lewis lived and worked with urgency because the task was urgent. But even though the world around him gave him every cause for bitterness, he stubbornly treated everyone with respect and love. All so that, as his friend Dr. King once put it, we could build a community at peace with itself. Today, we pray and trust that this peacemaker himself now rests in peace.
Tito, this was a man who was beaten so badly by state troopers in Selma in 1965 that his skull was fractured. He was arrested over 40 times from 1960 to 1966. He did remain positive and loving, but I'm also mindful of Dr. King's teachings about righteous love and John Lewis talking about making good trouble. What about peace and love and good troublemaking all at the same time?
So I also heard the majority leader speak about slavery, and to finally acknowledge it was America's original sin. Understand that love and peacemaking is not docile. It actually shows strength, and it requires, for someone to get beat and to not fight back, as was the training at the time, it required people to have a level of inner strength that many had a difficult, would have a very difficult time experiencing. So I think, you know, the leader, in addition to observing John Lewis, I think he would do well to actually begin to ingest and mimic what John Lewis did in his lifetime. And there's a lot to be said about what can and should happen in Washington for folks to do that. And as was stated a little bit earlier, leaderful. I love that terminology, Reverend. That's a great way to think about it, because if we all do a little bit, then no one individually has to do a lot. And that's what this is about in terms of building a movement.
Reverend Mariama, I want to play you some sound from John Lewis himself. His illness left him sort of sidelined during the massive protests we saw over the killing of George Floyd this spring. But he said he cried watching the video of Floyd being killed. And he told CBS that he was moved by the magnitude and diversity of the protests that followed.
To see people from all over the world taken to the streets, to the roadways, to stand up, to speak up, to speak out, or to do what I call getting in trouble. And with the sense of determination and commitment and dedication, there would be no turning back. People now understand what the struggle was all about.
So part of the reason that that was so striking, Reverend Mariama, was that he did an interview on Radio Boston in 2013. And he said then he thought people were too quiet. It sounds like before his death, he had become satisfied that people were too quiet no longer. What's your reaction to that?
Yeah, I mean, that's, again, the message that I heard from him as a young person. He was very clear that they had done some great things during the civil rights movement, but that the struggle was far from over. And one of the things he sort of reminded us is to learn about the history, but not in an effort to lionize it, but in an effort to think about what our role is. I mean, I concur with Tito, this whole theme of passing the torch. I think the truth is that a lot of the challenges we've been seeing that have been exposed by COVID, that have been lifted up by the death of George Floyd, these are not new things. They have existed. What has changed is our will to do something about them. And I'm really thankful that he got to see this before he passed on. I think those of us being willing to take to the streets is probably one of the best gifts, parting gifts, we could give to him. His work is done. And he did more than his fair share, more than his fair share for us. I agree wholeheartedly with Tito. We don't need each individual person to do quite as much if all of us pull our weight. And I think over these last few months, more of us have said, what can I do? What sacrifice can I make? How can I put some skin in the game to really do something about transforming this country? So I'm really excited. I've had the opportunity to walk the Edmund Pettus Bridge many times. I'm excited about the idea that it might be named after him. He deserves that. And he is a much greater figure to lionize than Mr. Pettus, who was a white supremacist. So I think, you know, I'm really glad.
I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt you there, Reverend Marianne. I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but I want to get a little more sound in and have a little more time for Tito to respond to that. So I apologize. Give me just a second, because I do want to play one more piece from the ceremony today, which is House Majority Leader Nancy Pelosi.
John firmly focused on the future, on how to inspire the next generation to join the fight for justice. And his quote, to find a way to get in the way. As one of the youngest leaders of the Freedom Rides, March on Washington, as I said, and March to Montgomery, he understood the power of young people to change the future.
So we're hearing that, and we're hearing what Reverend Mariama was just saying, Tito Jackson, resonating all over the country now. And in our last little minute or so, I just want to ask, what is the exhortation to young people that his passing now lays out?
Get up, stand up, for your rights. It's absolutely critical that young people now, and they are doing this, and understand it also is a message to older folks. I guess I technically am in that category now, to step back and let young people step forward and lead, let their voices be heard, and their truths be told. There's a component, as we saw from Congressman John Lewis, he did that. He embodied that, and it wasn't only about him. It was a life of passing the torch, and he has lived a life that was well-lived, and his dash that will go on his headstone means something, and it means that our country is better, different, and many things have changed because of his living.
And Reverend Mariama, let me give you 30 seconds to just add your last reflection. It didn't sit right with me to interrupt you like that.
No, it's all good. I mean, I think I'm honored to have known him, and I hope that so many more folks will get out there, buy the book, march, share it with a young person. It's not going to be overnight that change happens, but we can hold his legacy and move forward.
And that is Reverend Mariama White Hammond, pastor of the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester. Thanks for being with us today.
Good to be here.
And Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor, now CEO of Verdant Medical, a cannabis company. Tito, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Voters have little more than a month before the September 1st primaries, and Senator Ed Markey and Representative Joe Kennedy continue to struggle to differentiate themselves in a race for the U.S. Senate, a seat that Markey currently holds. The two squared off last night in the latest Democratic debate, and though sparks did fly, it's not clear whether that's going to be enough to start any fires for either candidate, with Democratic primary voters who may still be undecided. So joining us to talk about the state of the race is WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, welcome.
Hi, Tiziana.
So, Anthony, you've covered lots of campaigns. How would you describe the mood and tone of this primary right now?
Well, I guess, you know, a couple of ways to answer that. If you talk about the sort of energy in the debate, it's getting pretty angry. But, you know, I've been saying from the beginning that this is a tough race for Massachusetts Democrats to process because, you know, despite all the heat in these debates, and there was surely some heat last night, Markey and Kennedy agree on just about every major issue. So, you know, do you give credit to Markey for being one of Washington's most consistent progressives? And if you do, why do you throw him out of office? Or do you buy Kennedy's argument that Markey's part of this old system that got us to where we are today and it's time for new leadership? And Kennedy's a guy who kind of looks like new leadership, and he's a Kennedy. But I come back to this idea. At the end of the day, there aren't like some huge defining political issue around policy that separates them, not at all. So it's a confusing race, I think.
That is interesting. Let's talk a little bit about where they are trying to land blows. The Boston Globe is out with a new report today analyzing Markey's travel records, which was something he had promised to put out in the last debate. It finds he spends less time in Massachusetts than the rest of the delegation. It really struck out to me that in 2017, he spent just 77 nights in his home state. How is he responding to these accusations and to this data?
Yeah, I mean, this analysis from the Globe of these travel records is interesting. You mentioned a fact there that's important. You know, I would put it this way. So from January 2017 through this past spring, that's a 2.5-year period, Markey spent less than a third of his time at his Malden home. The rest of the time, he was living in Chevy Chase, Maryland. So at a campaign event in Medford just today, I asked Markey about this, and he defended all that time out of state and said he sought to balance the time between Washington and Massachusetts. Here's a bit of what he said.
I've managed this balance between Washington and Massachusetts throughout the years, and obviously I do so in partnership with all of these local officials. And I think ultimately the question is going to be, did I deliver? Then I stand up and fight for and deliver for these communities. And I have done that over and over again.
And Tiziana, we should mention that Markey was speaking there in Medford, where a bunch of local officials, including the mayor of Medford, the state senator there, gave him credit for, among other things, securing hundreds of millions of dollars in federal spending for the Green Line extension. So this is the kind of thing that Markey talks about, that he's not only leading, he's delivering. And that was part of his defense today.
But this is a place where Kennedy is going after him, trying to distinguish himself. Is that right?
No, it's absolutely a place where he's doing that. You heard it in the debate last night. You know, Kennedy is accusing Markey of absentee leadership, and he's saying that it's important to be here in the state. And, you know, I think by releasing these travel records, it's just going to give Kennedy more fuel to pound away on this issue. Here he is speaking at the debate last night.
I went around the country trying to campaign for other Democrats so that we could regain control and pass a progressive agenda. Senator Markey, by his own campaign's admission, went nowhere. But he wasn't at home either. You talk to folks around Western Massachusetts. You talk to folks across communities like Roxbury and Dorchester and Mattapan and Springfield and Worcester. And he wasn't there. There is so much more that is needed at this moment than just somebody that files the right bill and says that that's enough.
So, you know, Kennedy later in that debate said, you know, we need to have elected officials who are, in fact, hearing the concerns across our Commonwealth and advocating for those voices. And his claim is that by spending so much time out of state, Markey isn't doing that.
So we said we were going to try to sort of illustrate the blows they're both trying to land. So what blows is Markey trying to land? How's he painting
right.
Kennedy?
Yeah, well, Markey's main pitch that he has a long record of successful progressive leadership, and this goes way back to the nuclear freeze movement in the 1980s. More recently, he co-sponsored Medicare for All and the Green New Deal with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. He's pushed for net neutrality and LGBTQ rights. And his main case against Kennedy is that the congressman doesn't have a credible record as a progressive, that he's shifted positions over time. For example, he points out that after Kennedy graduated from law school, he went to work for Cape and Islands District Attorney Michael O'Keefe, a tough law and order conservative. And there have been other policies that Kennedy has shifted his stance on. And Markey asked the question last night in the debate, you know, was this political convenience, you know, or was it conviction? And obviously his suggestion is that it's political convenience so that he can, you know, so that he can get into the Senate.
You know, I don't think that the stakes are low here, but as you talk about them trying to distinguish themselves from each other, I think about when I was in academia, there was a saying that the battles are so fierce because the stakes are so low. And I do find, you know, in you talking about this battle over who's more progressive when they hold similar policies, is one of them more progressive than the other?
Well, it depends who you talk to. So it's interesting. I mean, if you say they're both progressives, and I've said this in my reporting, I got absolutely hammered on Twitter by Markey supporters who, you know, basically say it's just absolutely absurd to call Kennedy a progressive because of his past, of some of his past positions. And because Markey, you know, does deserve this reputation as a solid, consistent progressive advocate in Washington for decades. Now, that said, there are places that actually measure. There's a website, and I'm blanking on the name, that actually scores progressive votes in Congress. And Markey got like a 98% score, and Kennedy got a 97% score. So in terms of how they vote and the issues they support, they're very, very similar. But I think it is fair to say that, you know, Markey's been in office since before Kennedy was even born. He's been in Washington since before Kennedy was even born. He has a much longer record as a progressive. I think you can say that without getting much debate. So that's where it is. But again, on the issues, there's not a dime's width between them.
So then we've got to turn to, you know, the differentiation that we can see. I'm thinking, you know, polling numbers, fundraising numbers. According to that stuff, where does the race stand right now?
Well, when Kennedy jumped into this race, he jumped out, according to the polls, with a pretty sizable lead. And a lot of that had to do with just because how well Kennedy's name polls in this state. You know, if you're young, if you're handsome, and you're named Kennedy, you're going to poll better than just about anyone in the state. But as the race went on, that difference tightened. And the last poll, which is still months ago before the pandemic, showed that it had tightened quite a bit. So we don't have recent polling numbers. My guess is it's close. In terms of the fundraising numbers, Markey might even have a slight edge. The Markey people are very happy with the latest quarter that not only showed them raising a lot of money, but lots of donations and small amounts of donations. But they're basically tied in terms of their fundraising. Markey had a slight edge. Now, Markey is out with his first ad in the race, and it's a clear response to Kennedy's attacks because he really plays up his Malden roots and service to the community. We can listen to a little bit of that if you want.
This is where I'm from. My father was a milkman. I drove an ice cream truck to pay for college. Lessons I learned here still drive me today. Don't be scared of the tough fights. That's why I was an original sponsor of Medicare for All, and why I wrote the Green New Deal to fight climate change. Remember where you come from. Stand up for people counting on you, and always be a leader in the fight for justice.
Now, Tiziana, of course, you can't see the ad, but among other things, you see Markey walking through the gritty streets of Malden. His sleeves are rolled up. He's wearing his Air Jordans, which is a very Malden kind of thing. And the ad makes the point that not only this is where he's from, but how different his blue-collar background is from Kennedy's world of privilege. But in a campaign between two people who agree on most major issues, you know, Kennedy is hoping to convince voters that by spending so much time away from Massachusetts, Markey, yes, he's the son of a milkman, but he's also become a creature of Washington. So we'll see if that sticks. But that's clearly what Kennedy is hoping to do here.
Well, we'll keep watching it with you. That's WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Thanks a lot, Anthony.
My pleasure, Tiziana.
Messages for social change come in all different forms. Over the past few months, students from Berklee College of Music turned theirs into song for an annual contest. WBUR's Andrea Shea spoke to three winners, along with their professor, about their submissions.
Associate songwriting professor Mark Simos has facilitated Berklee's Songs for Social Change contest for about a decade. This year, he and eight judges from different departments assessed 90 submissions students had to record and produce at home after the school's shift to remote learning.
These songs all got submitted really before the pandemic hit in full, although there were some songs that dealt with that theme. And Madison's song, Quilt Too Big to Fold, which is about the AIDS epidemic, winds up having some eerie significance now, which I'm sure she can talk about.
Hello, my name is Madison Simpson. I'm from Concord, New Hampshire. When I was writing this song, the first line that came to me was the refrain line.
Saying, Nancy, you're the smartest girl I know, but all you do is sit all day and sew.
Simpson says her song is inspired by the AIDS Memorial quilt.
It's constantly growing. It's the largest piece of community folk art and, like, just so large that it can't even be shown in one place anymore.
You can hear the threads of the quilt in the way that the melodies and the lyrics are woven together in the song.
Simpson's character is stitching a fabric square to honor a loved one who contracts the disease.
Walking through the room as she got sicker, feeling like I'm already alone.
Simpson, who's bisexual, says a lot of people don't know about the millions of lives lost to AIDS.
This crisis was a really large part of our history, whether you're gay or straight or whatever. And it is still impacting us as a society today.
While Simpson's song is personal, it's not autobiographical. But Berkeley senior Gaia Mannin's Privilege to Dream is. It's about her family's experience as immigrants in Doha, Qatar. She says her dad migrated there from India in 1990.
We're still on a visa. It isn't necessarily a country where they give out citizenship. So despite having given most of our lives to this place and contributing to its economy and building a family and home there, we're deprived of a lot of privileges, certain rights like owning land.
How do you call yourself the land of the kind when we're forced to leave when dad retires?
Simos points to Mannin's choice to repeat questions that probe the concept of privilege in both Qatar and the U.S., where she's also on a visa as an international student.
Asking it as a question is a really powerful way to kind of invite the listener in and kind of open up that space.
We don't choose the circumstances that we're born into, you know? And therefore, I shouldn't have to be defined by them.
So it's clear to see if you're destined to be me. It's a privilege to dream.
I'm sure for all of the writers, it feels a little awkward to be talking in this way about what they've so artfully put into the song itself. As songwriting teachers, we actually encourage people to trust the song to do its own work.
The song does it way better than anything that I can say.
That's Al Reardon of Newcastle, Australia. Her winning song is Listen and Love.
I wanna write a song to the girls who are afraid to share their story, to the girls that were hurt and were told that they were wrong.
I was coming from my own experience as a woman who's being raped and sexually assaulted, but I really wanted to try and extend the message to all kinds of pain from all different people, if that makes sense.
Reardon wrote and mixed her song the day before the contest deadline after coming up with these lyrics.
If only the world was a place where people wouldn't sew others' pain into t-shirts to wear as their own.
When you're a songwriter, there's certain lines that just kind of kill you, and you're just going to go, oh, wish I'd written that line.
Like a lot of the songs submitted this year, Simo says Reardon's channels a next level of social awareness about what it means to be an ally in today's world.
So when someone shares their story, don't say me too, say I see.
That story from WBUR's Andrea Shea. Stay tuned. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.
Don't say it's okay. Tell them you're on their side at the end of the day.
week alone, the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy's Sharktivity app has logged at least 27 shark sightings in Massachusetts waters, most of them right off the coast of Cape Cod, sometimes yards from the beach. It is a busy time of year for sightings, especially as the thermometer hits, well, what feels like 100, and folks are looking for some relief by socially distancing at the beach. Now, last summer, we spoke with conservationist William McKeever about sharks and how they're not human-eating killers, like in Jaws, but essential parts of our fragile ocean ecosystem, and they need our protection. He had just released his book, Emperors of the Deep, Sharks, the Ocean's Most Mysterious, Most Misunderstood, and Most Important Guardians. It's now out in paperback. So today, we want to revisit our conversation, which began with what he thinks we, everyday people, misunderstand about sharks.
I think that what has happened in this country is that ever since Jaws came out, there's been this perception that sharks are man-eaters, and that if they come across a human being, they're going to take advantage of that and attack. The reality is very different. Sharks have been around for 450 million years, and they're programmed to eat fish and seals and sea lions and not people. So when they do come across a person, they typically swim away. Now, there are times when sharks make mistakes and there are bites, and sometimes something untoward happens, but these are very, very rare events. Sharks are in the surf constantly, and considering our thousands of miles of coastline, it's remarkable that they're only 50 to 55 bites a year. That just shows you that they're not interested.
I hear you, and I do understand what you're saying. I find myself thinking at the same time, you know, there was a death of a 26-year-old, Arthur Medici, last summer on Cape Cod. I know that was a mistake, but that is a costly, costly mistake from a shark. Shouldn't that put healthy fear into people about this apex predator?
I think if we need to put it into perspective, Tiziana, and that is that whenever you go into the ocean, you're entering a wilderness area, much in the way as if you were going into Yellowstone Park in the backwoods. You don't know what you're going to encounter. And when you indeed go in that area, I think you have to be respectful of sharks. They are apex predators. They're at the top of the pyramid. So you don't want to have an interaction with them. And I think that's the takeaway message here. It's not that we should be afraid. The fact is there are 3 million surfers in this country. And this is the time of the year when they're out enjoying the ocean. And there are plenty of YouTube videos of showing sharks actually swimming amongst the surfers. And I think it's a tragedy for people to waste the psychic energy. Now, I think if you see a shark in the water, obviously it's best to leave until they swim away. So you want to, again, be respectful. But in terms of bringing this fear, I think that's misplaced.
You know, when I was reading your book, Emperors of the Deep, one of the things that you reframed in my head for me in reading the book is I always think of sharks as being biters. But after reading the book, what I found myself thinking of is they're mouthers, like a baby to encounter something puts everything in its mouth, right? Because that's how it encounters what's new. And my sense from your book was that often that's what sharks are doing. It's how they touch or check things out. Am I understanding that correctly?
That's a very good point, Tiziana. And in fact, you'll see many times on YouTube, underwater camera operators, you know, when that underwater camera is actually sending out electrical signal, that attracts a shark's attention.
Do they read electrical signals?
Yes. Every animal, every creature in the ocean sends off an electric field. And the sharks have evolved over this time to be able to sense it. And so as an example, so you're an underwater photographer, you've got a tiger shark in front of you. That tiger shark is looking at the camera and may take a bite just to see what it is. It's similar to our hands. You know, we'd like to touch and feel. Mm-hmm. For a shark, it's a little nip. And so that's how they get information. So I think your point is well taken.
You went out, you know, if you will, kind of to use your hands to touch and feel sharks yourself. But before you went into the water, you went to a shark hunting tournament. What was that like?
That was just one of the saddest events I've ever been to in my life.
Why?
So here I am walking in Montauk, and I always love the ocean and et cetera. And so I'm walking along, and I see all of these sharks, makos, tiger sharks, thresher sharks, they're hanging from yardarms as if they were common criminals who had to be executed for some crime. And it made me so sad because here are these beautiful animals. They've done nothing wrong. So it got me going to find out, well, what's the real story here? Maybe they do deserve this kind of treatment. So I ended up going 2.5 years around the world talking to scientists and diving with sharks to find out what the truth was. And I was shocked at what I learned. And I learned so much. And I put it into this book, Emperors of the Deep, The Shark, to tell people that the views of sharks are just these myths that have been created over decades. And we need to revisit them. And so I look back now on that shark tournament, and it energized me to do everything I can to stop the tournaments, but more importantly, to think about ways we can save sharks around the world, because they are being massacred. 100 million sharks are being killed every year. Sharks are experiencing the greatest threat to their existence in a 450-million-year history, and that's something that I think is a great tragedy and makes me sad.
You know, that those numbers are especially, you know, anxiety-inducing when one reads, as one does in your book, about the important role of sharks in balancing an ocean ecosystem. That's not how I'm used to thinking of an apex predator. Wow, there's this fragile ecosystem, something's got to keep it in balance, and it's an apex predator who does that. But you write that that actually is a really important role that the shark plays.
Yes, it is. And, you know, the old view is that, well, apex predators kill. This actually should be flipped on its head. Apex predators give life. They keep systems in balance. The best example, just to very quickly, maybe easy to grasp the concept, is that you may remember in Yellowstone, they took the wolves out thinking that, well, we'll have all these deer we can hunt. And it was an ecological disaster. The rivers actually started to meander more, and several species of animals, beaver, lynx, started to suffer. And they, rightly so, brought the wolves back. And it had a dramatic transformation on Yellowstone. The rivers flowed straighter again, and the beaver came back, and it was dramatic. And so we go now into the ocean. The same concept applies, Tiziana. The apex predator in the ocean is the shark. And when that shark comes into the ocean, it prevents any one species of fish from monopolizing resources, whether it's on a reef or in a seagrass system. So by keeping that balance, we keep the oceans healthy. There are plenty of fish that we can eat and provides jobs. And I could go through, I spent hours with you on this because it's fascinating, about in every ecosystem, sharks are doing something very important, whether it's seagrass systems or reefs or open water systems. The sharks are there, and they are a keystone species in the ocean that we need.
Yeah, I haven't really thought of them before as sort of Jedis who keep balance in the force of the ocean. It's a really different way to think about them. And I want to, there's one other subject I want to make sure that we get to with you, because you talk in your book about the tensions between sharks in the commercial fishing industry. You call out the tuna industry, but that's not the only industry you call out. As you, I'm sure, know, fishing industry is quite important here in the Commonwealth. Is there a way to have commercial fishing and have sharks thrive?
Yes, there is. And that's a great question, because I think there's this view that, well, if sharks cost jobs or they reduce income, then that's just the price they have to pay. The reality is that we can construct a regulatory system that allows sharks to survive and allows fish to be caught sustainably so that we can continue to fish for tuna or whatever it is for the indefinite future. And the current regulations that we have are just antiquated. They should be thrown out. Now, I'll be the first to say, in the United States, we do a pretty good job of managing our fish populations. But when you get outside of the United States and you go on the high seas in the Pacific Ocean, it is the wild, wild west out there. These fishing boats are setting lines that are 100, 150 miles long. They're catching seabirds and turtles and all kinds of bycatch and killing them by the hundreds of thousands. And that's where sharks are getting massacred, because those fishing vessels, which are manned by slaves, surprisingly, they're finning those sharks to get the fin to sell them so they can get some money in, because they're not being paid a living wage. So you get this massacre of sharks. You get overfishing in the areas like the Pacific Ocean, and it's detrimental to all mankind. And my book makes a point that if we step back and put in the right kinds of regulations, this does not have to happen. We can make a difference.
So in our last minute or so, if you could pick one change to shark policy, either domestically or globally, if you could pick one, what would it be?
I would do this. I would create more marine protected areas. And what I mean by an MPA or marine protected area is where you set aside an area of the ocean where there's no commercial fishing at all. And all the fish in there get a chance to breed, grow up, expand, go elsewhere. This is where we create the ability of fish populations to recover from commercial fishermen. The United Nations has called for 20% of the oceans to be in MPAs by, I believe it's 2020. The scary thing is that today, only 3% of the oceans are in marine protected areas. So if we were to, and Greenpeace has called out for this, and I agree with them, we should put 30% of the oceans in marine protected areas by 2030. That can save sharks, save tuna, and the commercial fishing industry around the world.
Okay, in 10 seconds or so, what would your message be to our Cape Cod listeners or folks who are headed out into the water today or this weekend?
I would say enjoy the beach. You've worked hard. You deserve this vacation. The ocean is a wonder. And just be respectful. Be careful. Don't swim at night. Sharks are nocturnal. Swim within the break line and keep an eye out, and you'll be fine. And just enjoy it. So take advantage of that great ocean, the Cape, and that the islands offer people who live in Boston.
William McKeever is a conservationist and founder of Safeguard the Seas. He spoke with us last summer when his book, Emperors of the Deep, Sharks, the Ocean's Most Mysterious, Most Misunderstood, and Most Important Guardians, first came out.